University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Tahira Aftab, Professor of History at the University of Karachi, Karachi, Pakistan. Her lecture is entitled Islamic Law and Women's Rights. Aftab, a visiting Fulbright scholar, has researched education, women's rights, and social change in the late 19th century. Areas of specialization include Muslim women's education in North India in the 19th century, architectural traditions in South Asia, and changes in women's status through legislation in Pakistan.
Dr. Tahira Aftab, Professor of History at the University of Karachi, is with us today to speak on Islamic law and women's rights in Pakistan. As you can tell from the title of her talk, she has a special interest in women's issues, both historically and currently. As a visiting Fulbright scholar at Mount Holyoke, South Hadley, Massachusetts, she is researching the American women who were missionaries in India during the second half of the 19th century. Because many of the American missionary women who went to the Punjab in the 19th century were educated at Holyoke and at their seminary, Dr. Aftab has found her residence to be especially appropriate to her research topic. She has found the many journals published in the region during the 19th century to be extremely valuable research items. In addition to her current research, Dr. Aftab has compiled an annotated bibliography of Muslim women of South Asia, which served as a research guide to others studying South Asia women's issues. She has published 17 papers on issues related to South Asian women's issues. In addition to her professional accomplishments, Dr. Aftab describes herself as a real good mother. She has a son and a daughter who are living with her in the United States. Her children are especially looking forward to a trip to Disney World. And if you have visited with Dr. Aftab, you can appreciate that those personal anecdotes are very important to her. She is concerned that we get to know the Muslims, who they are, what their problems are, what their concerns are. She encourages questions from you. We will have a talk back question time at Callan afterwards. But in order to encourage understanding at this point, she said if there's any difficulty at all and you're understanding what she has to say, simply raise your hand. She'll repeat, and she'll be very pleased to encourage understanding in that respect. So please welcome Dr. Tahira Aftab, Professor of General History, University of Karachi, Karachi, Pakistan.
Thank you very much. It's indeed a great pleasure for me to be here this morning to talk about a subject which is very dear and to me, and I'm greatly interested in it, and I hope I'll be able to get your interest also in this subject during this 1 hour talk and discussion that we are going to have. Now, the topic is Islamic laws and women's rights. So that means that there are three major things that I'm going to talk about: Islam, laws, and women's rights. The three, in my view, in my opinion, are not different. They are related to each other, and I'll be making an effort to show here how far are they related or are they not related, and what's happening to women in the Islamic world. Now, we get a lot of information about the Muslims, and I think I would start here by saying who the Muslims are. And then, of course, we would come who the Muslim women are, what are they doing, and what Muslim men are doing, and what's happening between Muslim men and Muslim women, and how this question of the rights of Muslim women has come up and has taken the interest, or the interest of the world has been created in this issue. Now, to begin with, Islam is a religion. It's not a new religion which came into existence, say, in the 7th century AD. The Muslims believe that it is an old religion which was revealed to the first man and to the first woman, that is to Adam and Eve. And that God, throughout this whole history of human creation, had been sending down messengers and prophets with the same mission. And so, the holy book of the Muslims, the Quran, says that you have to accept and have faith and belief in all the religions which had been revealed before the advent of Islam. So we find the name of Moses, we find the name of Jesus, and all those who have these revealed books or scriptures are known as Ahle Kitab, that is, the people of the books. And we accept them as such. Now, it was in Arabia, Saudi Arabia, where the message of Islam, according to the Muslim belief, was revealed to the Prophet of Islam through the agency of God's messenger, Gabriel, we call Jibrail. For 22 years, continuously, the message was revealed, certain intervals, whenever there was a need, a surah or a verse of the Quran was revealed. And the Prophet learned it, and he repeated it, and his companions, friends, and followers learned it by heart. And then it was written down on pieces of paper, on stones, bones, or leather, or any other such material. After the death of the Prophet, this message, which was in different forms or scattered pieces, was compiled together. And at least 25 such original copies called Mushaf were prepared. Now these Mushaf, there were 25 such copies, and these were sent to different Muslims who were living in various parts of Saudi Arabia and other areas which had come under the influence of Islam. And thus, a great effort was taken to see that the version is authentic and that there are no mistakes or differences. And thus, even now, in the 20th century, there are special institutions where special care is taken to see that there is no change in the actual text of the Quran. Now, why I am emphasizing this aspect of the Quran is because Quran is the basic source of Islamic law. And so the authenticity of the text is of great prime importance for the Muslim and for the Muslim community, that is the Ummah. So the Quran is the word of God. And because it is the word of God, no human being, no human agency, no human institution has got the right to change that. It cannot be altered, it cannot be changed, it cannot be reformed, because it does not need that reform. It has to be accepted as it is. There cannot be any compromise, there cannot be any adjustment, nothing. It is there, and you have to accept it or you have to reject it. If you are a Muslim, you accept it. If you reject it, you are out of that order. That is what the Muslim is supposed to have, the faith. Now I come to the next issue, that is women, what the women are doing. Now, in the 20th century, a major challenge, and I say major, I underline this, a major challenge confronts the world of Islam, and the challenge is of reconstructing its laws as they are practiced in the Muslim world concerning women, in a way that is commensurate with the law of Islam and not against it. Now, the Muslim countries today suffer from a widespread problem of women's underdevelopment, non-utilization, or underutilization of women resources with consequent poverty, lack of social stability, and overall backwardness. There is no debate about this issue. No two opinions. It is a fact. And we cannot overlook it. We cannot bypass this problem. The paradox of the Muslim world today is that its law, the law of the Quran, the law of the text which I addressed, referred earlier, confers, gives a high status to women. But practically, this law is drastically flouted. That is a paradox. Muslim men so far have totally refused to acknowledge this paradox. And that is the problem that the Muslim women are facing. That is the challenge. They have to find out an alternative. And today, I'm going to discuss, is there any alternative? Is there any possibility? Is there any hope for the women amongst the Muslims, or the Muslim women? Now I come back to my old issue, that is the Quran. And I say that the Quran says, I quote here, this is the translation. And when I say this translation, I must mention here, and I must emphasize this point, that the Quran, the revealed text in the written form, is in the Arabic language. It's a very important point to note, because all of us, the Muslims, do not understand the Arabic language as an Arab would understand. And that means that requires translation. And in order to translate, you have to be masters of the language. There are root words, and sometimes it often happens that a word is translated in different ways. And that causes a lot of problems. In fact, most of the problems are because of these translations, of the variations in the translation. So the translation says, O ye who believe, that is, God is addressing the Muslims, O ye who believe, enter into Islam wholeheartedly. So that is a positive directive. Enter into Islam wholeheartedly. You have to accept it completely. And it is followed by another order, and that is another negative one. And follow not the footsteps of the evil one, for he is to you an avowed enemy. So that means that you are not supposed to adopt ways, manners, customs, traditions, philosophies, attitudes, behavioral patterns of people who are outside your society. It's a very important thing. I would be coming back to this point, so please keep it in mind. And perhaps you would like me to ask questions about it also. Now, next to the Muslims, to this faith in the Quran, this explicit, deep-rooted, basic faith in Islam, there is another source of Islamic law, and that is the Prophet Muhammad. Now, Prophet is an ordinary human being of Arab origin. But he is not just the messenger. His whole life is supposed to be, by a Muslim, an example to be followed. The Quran declares that Muhammad, the Prophet, peace be upon him, is sent as a great favor on the believers. Why? Because, I again quote from the Quran, Allah did confer a great favor on the believers when he sent among them the apostle from among themselves, rehearsing unto them the signs of Allah, sanctifying them and instructing them in scripture and wisdom, while before they had been in manifest error. So what is the duty, or what is the life of the Prophet? That he is putting into practice the word of God. So if you are not able to understand the Quran, you have another source, you look at the life of the Prophet and see what he did, how he lived his life. And so these sayings, or his way of life, his behavioral pattern, that is called the Sunnah, S-U-N-N-A. So after the Quran, the second is the Sunnah, that is what the Prophet did. This is the second source of the Islamic law, the traditions of the Prophet. So the Prophet was sent not to one nation or one people or for a particular time period, for one century. No. The Quran says, we have sent thee as a universal messenger. So that means his message is for all people and for all the times to come. That means, again, we come back to the same point, that the traditions even cannot be altered and changed. So that change is not possible, neither in the text of the Quran nor in the traditions of the Prophet, and they are for all the time to come. What the problems we are facing in the 20th century, we can look back and see and what the Prophet did. And can we find an answer in that? So all the laws coming from the Quran are called Sharia. That is the technical word we have, the Sharia, which in Arabic literally means the path, the road, the way to be followed. And a Muslim is supposed to follow that. And all the commandments in the Quran are called hukm. That is the commandments. And the plural will be ahkam. A Muslim is supposed to follow these ahkam and these messages. The sunnah of the Prophet is the model behavior, and these two are the basic. Now, besides these, there are other. And that we come to the most complicated issue now. This is called ijma. Ijma means consensus of opinion. Now, suppose there is a problem and you do not find it mentioned in the Quran, nor you do find in the sunnah of the Prophet, what the Muslims are going to do? A consensus of opinion amongst the elders and the scholars. Scholars, not say people like me and you and those who haven't gone into the detailed study of the Quran and the traditions. No, the scholars who have spent their lifetime in studying the scripture and in studying the life of the Prophet. So that will be a ijma. Then even if ijma fails to help you to get an answer to your problems, you have another method, and that is called qiyas, analogy. So now we have four sources. Even if these four sources fail, are not going to help you, there are two other. That is, under mursalai mursala. That is, if it is for the welfare of the people in general, then you can find an answer which is not repugnant to the first two. So that means there is a lot of flexibility. Now, the traditions of the Prophet were compiled immediately after his death, and by the 8th century AD, we had at least six great compilations of the traditions of the Prophet. Now, of course, there are variations, and some are supposed to be authentic traditions, some are supposed to be doubtful traditions, and the Muslims developed a special science called isnad to establish the authenticity of the various traditions narrated by those who were contemporaries of the Prophet, or those who were friends of the Prophet, and later on those who have heard it from their parents or from their friends. And so according to the time lag, according to the distance of the narrator, authenticity of our tradition is established. Now, I won't go into the details because that's a totally separate subject for us to study today. Now, following the death of the Prophet, as those who know about world history must be knowing that at a great speed, the political power and the military power of the Muslims spread. And beyond Arabia, countries, areas, geographical areas, like Spain and in Central Asia, Iraq, Iran, and Central Asia came under the sway of the Muslims. And that means totally different ethnic groups, geographical areas came under the influence of the Muslims. And there was bound to be an intermixture, admixture, synthesis. And some local people, when they accepted Islam, they had their own traditions. Islam had its own lesson to taught them. to teach them, and so there were certain adjustments were made. Now, adjustments could not be made in these. And you know the power of traditions, that it is very difficult to change traditions. But traditions do change, because how the traditions are formed. That means this is out of a process of change itself. But it's a difficult process. It's a complicated process. But mind you, there has never been a static period in history. Change has always been there. Innovations have always been there. So we accept it. All those who have studied history know it fully well, that change is a process which is bound to happen. How it should happen, that is the question. It is not that change is not going to come. Change is bound to take place. But how? Whether it should come from within or from outside? Who should be responsible? Who should be the agents of change? That is the question to be answered. And that is the major problem that the Muslims are facing at the moment, that how this change within their community should come through the West or through themselves. Now, the Islamic laws believe that there are two different categories of duties. Duties towards God, that means worship, offering prayers 5 times a day at fixed hours, paying your tax, that is zakat, offering your pilgrimage annually, at least once in your lifetime if possible, to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Now, those are the duties towards God. And then there are duties to one's fellow human beings. That is social transactions. And it is under this second aspect, social transactions, that the question of the family, of the civil laws, of commercial and family laws come. And it is here the issue of women come up. By the 10th century, Islamic Muslim scholars had written a lot of commentaries and compilations on the traditions of the Prophet. And by the time the Mongols invaded Baghdad and set fire to the libraries, by that time, another change had entered into the body politics of Islam. And they thought that now we have no need to have ijma, consensus of opinion. We have already discussed all the issues, we have got answers to all our problems, and now there is no further need to have this consensus of opinion. Questions have been answered, problems have been solved, and what is now left for the others is to follow. That is taqleed. You understand that? And so the Islamic scholars say that we have closed the gates of ijtihad, we have closed it now, no longer, and that is the static. That was the most dangerous thing that happened. And if you want to trace the degradation and downfall of Muslim women, if we have to choose a date, I would say, well, let's start it from there. See? No more. No answers. You just have to follow. And who should follow? Women. So now, ijtihad was closed. And women had to follow. Now I come to some of the most... Let me say what the Quran says about women. It addresses women and men together. The duties of men are the same, and the duties of women are the same. Well, of course, this is, as far as the first aspect is concerned, duties towards God. Men had to offer prayers 5 times a day, so also women have to offer prayers 5 times a day. They have to keep fast for 30 days, so women have to keep fast for 30 days. If men have to pay a zakat on their annual income, so women have to pay zakat. And that means that women have got a right to have their property and to earn money, because women have to pay zakat. They're not going to pay the zakat on the money of their husbands, because they're already paying their own zakat. And that definitely means... You see, you just cannot decide to take out certain verses out of the text of the Quran and say, well, here is the order that a woman is not supposed to work. When there is an order that a woman has to pay zakat, it means that she has her own money. As far as marriage, matrimony is concerned, And that is, I think, is the most debatable issue and the highly discussed point outside Islam and inside the Muslim community itself. That God has given a right to Muslim men to marry and have four wives. And we hear so much about the large number of wives kept by Muslim sultans and the harems, and there are some very romantic stories and tales about that. And we think, well, most probably all the Muslim women are suffering a lot. They must be co-wives and they must be fighting hard. And that Islam hasn't given the same right to women to have four husbands at a time. And so, well, there is discrimination. That Islam has given the right to a man to divorce his wife at his sweet will, and it hasn't given that right to women, and so again there is a discrimination. So, I mean, these are the major issues which are usually discussed in papers and all, and I'm coming to these issues now. I would start by saying this, that according to one of the sunnah of the Prophet, which is called the Hadith, women can act as prayer leaders. See, when prayers are offered in congregation, you have to have a leader to lead you in the prayer. And usually the task is performed by men now. And when we have this hadith before us, this tradition of the Prophet, that women can act as prayer leaders, the present practice when women are not allowed to offer their prayers in mosques becomes ununderstandable. That again, it is a conflicting issue. Secondly, the Prophet's tradition is that your wives are not your slaves and they should not be treated as such. The next issue is that Muslim women are supposed to be almost invisible. I hope you won't believe that, because now you're looking at me. And undoubtedly, I would say that I'm not a bad Muslim. Because I do pay the zakat, I do offer my prayers, and I do keep the 30 days fasts. Now, in the text of the Quran, the word V-E-I-L, veil, is not mentioned. The parda is not mentioned. Women who came to the Prophet to offer pledge of allegiance called bay'ah, that is, now I'm becoming a Muslim and read the kalima, la ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. That was the allegiance, the bay'ah. And when women came, they were not covered. And in fact, I must remind you here that when the first verse of the Quran was revealed to the Prophet, he immediately came back to his wife, Khadija, and said that this is what has happened to him. That is what he had experienced. And he didn't go to any men. He had his friends, his male friends there. But he came to his wife, consulted her, and she was the first person to accept the message. So we see that amongst all human beings, after the Prophet, who accepted Islam was Khadija, the Prophet's wife. And she was a business woman, sending caravans, business caravans to Syria and to several other areas. And she had big management, large number of employees she had. And that she continued to have even after marrying the Prophet, even after Islam was revealed. In fact, in the early society, Muslim society, in the time of the Prophet, women accompanied men into battle, even to participate actively in the battle, nursing the wounded, fetching the water, and recovering the dead. And this task was done by women in almost all the major battles that were fought by the Muslims, or battles between the Muslims and the non-Muslims in Arabia. And when women came to join Islam, it was their own free choice. And when we say now that in Islamic Muslim countries, women have got no right to offer to give testimony in the courts because they are women, it goes against this. When they came to join Islam, there was no other person to testify that now she is going to become a Muslim. Her own allegiance, her own acceptance as a woman was recognized by the Prophet. Muslim women were also traveling, and of course, there was no restriction on that. In pre-Islamic Arabia, at the time of marriage, when this contract was signed between the two families, the father or the would-be bride used to accept money from the bridegroom, from the man marrying his daughter or sister. And that was called mahar. And that means it was the price for the bride. What Islam did to the Arabian women and now to all other women was that this sum of money was the right of the woman herself, and that it could be paid immediately or whenever she could demand the payment. She could have her own property and she could maintain it. She would have a share out of the property of her husband and would have a share out of the property of her father. The share, of course, is fixed. To the son goes major portion and to the daughter, half of that. Now I come to the issue of four wives polygamy. And that is the most debated issue, that whether the men have the right to marry four wives simultaneously. Now, before I go into the details, as a historian, I would relate a little story. And that's about the time of Emperor Akbar. He was a 16th century ruler of Hindustan, and the Mughals were great empire builders and in South Asia, society, culture, art, architecture reached a great height of zenith. Akbar was a man who wanted to know exactly what are the laws of Islam. And at his court, the Hindus, the Buddhists, Parsis, Jains were all assembled. And in fact, you would be interested that it was for the first time that the Jesuit missionaries were invited by Akbar and they appeared at his court and they were allowed to discuss and propagate their faith, their Christianity. And some of these Christian fathers thought that perhaps the very fact that Akbar has allowed them to propagate their faith in his court is that he is no longer a Muslim. And so they went to the extent of using undesirable language for the Prophet of Islam, and there were fist fights between the Muslim theologians and these Christian fathers. But then the very fact is that Akbar got the Bible translated into Persian at this time, and he asked his two sons, Daniel and others, to wear the cross around their neck also. I mean, he was a liberal-minded person in that. Now, what's happened is that Akbar wanted this issue to be solved about the four wives. Because he said that if I have the right to marry four wives, what are the laws of the Quran? And he had two great Muslim scholars at his court. Now, these scholars wanted to please the emperor so that he could have as many wives as he wished or desired to have. And they said, well, the Quran says, marry women of your choice, two or three or four. And so they said, that means two and two and three and four, that you have 16 wives at a time. Understand that? Now see, here you find that how the scholars who have worldly interests try to give a twist to the actual text. Of course, later on, these two theologians were thrown out of the court and finally were put to death also, for certain other reasons, of course. Now I read out the verse of the Quran which has caused, or which has been interpreted in various ways. The verse says, now that is in connection with the treatment or the issue of the orphans in the society. The fatherless children and daughters who had their own property also. That is one chapter on them. And it's in the context of these orphans that this verse especially occurs. It says, if ye fear that ye shall not be able to deal justly with the orphans, marry women of your choice, 2 or 3 or 4. But if ye fear that ye shall not be able to deal justly with them, then only 1. Or that your right hand possesses, that will be more suitable to prevent you from doing injustice. Following this verse, there are several verses on the issue of injustice. That is, those who commit injustice, what happens to them? What are the punishments meted out to those people who would commit injustice? So that means that this whole verse is to be looked at in relation to or in the context of the major issue of injustice. Muslim men, when Islamic simplicity of the days of the Prophet and the Caliphs was no longer there, and when empires came into existence, the power of the Sultan and the King was there. And you must understand that kingdom, worldly power, empire is a total antithesis to Islamic ideal. Islam does not believe in hereditary institution of kingship. So, the rise of kingdoms, of sultanates, is totally against the Islamic laws. And thus, all that happened during this period of the rise, creation of kingdoms, is against the Islamic laws. And it was precisely during this stage, at this point of history, that this particular verse came to be interpreted in a way allowing men, especially the sultans, to have more than 1 wife. Because that was appeared precisely when the ideal of social justice, social balance, was completely neglected and forgot. In the 19th century, this issue was greatly debated upon and discussed, and it was felt by Muslim scholars and divines that though the verses of the Quran cannot be changed, but this particular verse, which occurs in chapter 4, verse number 3, does not give the right to Muslim women, to Muslim men, to marry 4 wives, because though, of course, there is no biological, I refer here to what happened in India in the 19th century and also in Egypt, where a great reform movement concerning the rights of women was started. And both Abduhu, a great reformer in Egypt, and Sayyid Ahmad Khan in India, and Afghani, Jamaluddin Afghani in the Middle East, believed that though there is no biological objection to a man's right to marry more than 1 wife, however, it goes against the practice, because he says that justice in a man-woman relationship can only be synonymous with love, and since it is emotionally not possible to love more than 1 woman equally at any given time, polygamy is prohibited, and it is against the law of Islam. It is not possible. And so it is against the law of Islam. On the basis of this, efforts were made to change the law of Islam. And when I say the law of Islam, I definitely mean the wrongly interpreted law of Islam. And so in Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, Turkey, India, through legislation, efforts were made to change this. And in 1939, the Muslim Family Law Ordinance was passed in British India, and which benefited greatly Muslim women belonging to all different schools of thought, say that women had a right to challenge their husband's privilege of marrying four wives at a time. Now I come to the next verse, the problem of parda, seclusion, segregation, invisibility or visibility of women. I quote two verses from chapter 24, verse 30 and 31. The Quran says, say to the believing men that they should, now see here the Quran is addressing men first, say to the believing men that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. That will make for greater purity for them. And Allah is well acquainted with all that they do. That means that though the Quran says that lower their gaze, but even what is there in their heart, even after lowering their gaze, Allah knows it. So it's purity of heart. You understand that? And it's a very clear verse. It's a very beautiful verse. It tells you exactly how you should pattern your behavior, mental, physical, all. It further says, verse 31, a beautiful verse indeed, and that's, it mean, it says that, that if we fear, be not too complacent of speech, lest one in whose heart is a disease should be moved with desire, but speak ye a speech just. See, that whatever you have to speak, speak clearly. It's not that you're just going to mumble a few words and say, create doubts and have not very well-balanced relationship. The Quran says that a woman, when she is stepping out of her house and she is moving in public, she should be properly dressed. And that she should be dressed up in a way as not intentionally trying to attract the attention of the opposite sex. And personally, I find nothing wrong with it, because that is the, what you call, the position of a woman, her own dignity. Why should she make an effort to attract men? That is below the dignity of a woman. And I think those who are the side of the feminists movement in the West would say that she is not a commodity on sale. She is not. And that is what Quran exactly means. Earlier, the practice in Arabia, in the pre-Islamic Arabia, was that women, when they used to walk on the in the streets in public, in order to attract the attention of men, they used to thump their feet like this, because they used to wear some anklets. And by making this crinkling sound with their thump of their feet, they used to attract women. And so the Quran says, do not wear these ornaments. Conceal your physical charms. And I don't think so, that a balanced woman would find anything wrong with that. Perhaps she would find it a hindrance in her day-to-day work if she is doing two things altogether, as a working woman and showing her charms also. Now, gradually what happened is that with the rise of men in power, with the establishment of, with the coming of imperialism, with the establishment of sultanates and kingdoms, and when wars were fought for the sake of expansion of territory, men came into power. And whenever there are men in power, when you find in where you have military regimes, martial laws, women suffer a lot, because usually women do not participate in these sorts of activities. So what happened in Islamic societies that with the rise and growth of this Islamic, this territorial acquisition and expansion of military power, men came to believe that they are the controllers, guardians, and protectors of women's modesty and chastity. And so, in order to protect it, the best way is that she should not be allowed to step out of the house. There is one verse in the Quran which says that one has an excellence over the other. And it has been interpreted by Muslim scholars saying that men have excellence over women and that men have got a right to control all the actions of their women. The verse says that men are the protectors and maintainers of women because Allah has given the one more strength than the other and because they support them from their means. Chapter 4, verse 34. Now, the verse simply states that the husband spends his money for the maintenance of his wife. This gives him a higher status. Now, according to the laws of the Quran and the Sunnah, it is the duty of the Muslim husband to spend money on the maintenance of his wife. If she demands a separate establishment, he has to provide. Even if she has her own property, even if she has her own money, she is not supposed to spend that on that, on her own maintenance. The husband has to provide every need. He has to give her clothes, and she doesn't have to stitch them for herself. She had to give her, the dress must be properly prepared. She is not supposed to cook for him. She is supposed to be provided with cooked meal by the husband. That is the law, of course. And that is another thing that wives do care and are the maintainers and they look after the management. But according to the law, a woman has a right that she must demand and her husband has to provide her with all these things. A house, and she is not supposed to work for him. And if she has to work for him, he has to pay money for it because she is working for him. Understand that? Now these are the laws, but then these are not practiced. I must admit this. I don't get any extra money for my husband for doing all sorts of odd jobs in the house. Now, this simple verse which I just quoted just now, that because Allah has given the one more strength because he spends money, came to be interpreted in various ways. And I'm going to do a little bit of reading here. I hope you would allow me that. One of the commentators, that is those who wrote a commentary and translation of the Quran, and his name was Tabari, T-A-B-A-R-I. He died in 923 A.D., that is, say, in the beginning of the 10th century. He comments that men are in charge of their women with respect to disciplining them. Now, the word discipline doesn't occur in this verse, but he reads that. He said, they are in charge of their women with respect to disciplining them, to providing them with restrictive guidance concerning their duties towards God and themselves, that is men. And thus God has given them excellence or preference over their wives because of the payment of their dower to them, spending of their wealth on them, and providing for them in full. Now, he restricts us to husband-wife relationship only. That is, all men do not have authority over all women. Understand that? It's only about husbands and wives. Because husbands are spending money on their wives, and so in that relationship, they have an excellence. Now, this verse came to be translated into several ways, and gradually women came to lose all their status in the Muslim society and rights, and I would explain it in this way, that this degradation of women further changed. I mean, the interpretation of the same verse was done in a different way. And in 1286, another commentator, whose name was Baidawi, he died in 1286, while he giving a translation of this verse, he says that men are in charge of men, of women, as rulers are in charge of their subjects. You see, you look at the change now? It is the same verse, but how he is interpreting it. He says, they are in charge of women as rulers are in charge of their subjects. He further lists several discriminations against women and says that God has preferred. Now see, he adds something extra to it. He says that God has preferred over men over women because men have better mental abilities, good counsels, complete power, and so they have been chosen as prophets, as God's representatives, and women have not been. And so men have an excellence, and so women have to obey the commands. Now that husband-wife relationship is not here. That means all women have to obey all men. All men are below men. That men have a higher status in society, and they are the commanders, and women have to follow them. That is in the 13th century, that's what happened. Now, the other problem is that about testimony. In Islamic courts, and the verse says, and get two witnesses out of you, and if they are not two men, then a man and two women, such as he choose. And so it has caused a lot of problem in Islamic countries, especially in Pakistan, where the process of Islamization is in progress at the time, since the coming of President Zia-ul-Haq in power and the establishment of the military regime. Now I'll come to my own country and what's happening there. Pakistan was created as a separate Islamic state in the name of religion, because the Muslims of India felt that in joint India, their rights were not properly guarded and protected, and as such, they had been living from the 7th century as a separate community, and that they should be allowed now to have their own homeland, separate homeland. And so in the name of religion, Islam came into an existence at a time when trends of secularism were becoming very powerful in the world around. And so Pakistan's creation in the name of religion is a very important factor in the history of mankind, undoubtedly. Now, immediately after the establishment of Pakistan in 1947, in Pakistan, things happened rather in a very different way. Even those Muslims who had opposed the establishment of Pakistan as a separate homeland of the Muslims came to this country. I especially refer to the leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami, Maulana Maududi. After the partition of the country, there had been a lot of bloodshed on both the sides of the frontier, in India and Pakistan, and a large number of Muslims migrated from the Indian side towards Pakistan and from Pakistan towards India. The Hindus from the Punjab migrated. And so there was murders, executions, deaths, killings on all both the sides. And at this time, the Muslim women in Pakistan came forward. Association, the All Pakistan Women's Organization Association was formed, and they worked as volunteers for the work of the rehabilitation of these dislocated families, and they worked for their rehabilitation. Not one single Muslim scholar came to say that they are doing something against the traditions of Islam. No fatwa, no religious decree at this time was issued. And that's a very important point for us to remember here. Now, Muslim men felt that because Islam, the country has been created in the name of religion, now they have got a right to suppress and to rule over women. But Muslim women came forward and demanded that these laws, as introduced in Pakistan or practiced in Pakistan, need to be revised through legislation. And so, after great struggle in 1961, Pakistan introduced the Muslim Family Laws Ordinance, a great achievement of women in Pakistan, undoubtedly. And the commission reported that polygamy is neither enjoined nor permitted unconditionally nor encouraged by the Holy Book. And it also said that polygamy causes a great social risk, social injustice, and the happiness of the family unit, which is the nucleus of all cultures and civilization, and especially Islam, is in great danger because of polygamy. And says, the constitution further said that this cannot be left to the sweet will of the individual man. And so special courts were created where women could challenge the right of their men having another wife after them. However, the decision was not unanimous. And there was one scholar, Muslim scholar, among, there were seven members of this commission. One was a woman, six were laymen, and one was theologian. And he was a very strong person of the Deobandi school of thought. Deoband is a religious seminary now in Saharanpur, India. And he said that by doing this, we are changing the law of Islam and it should not be done. And he presented a note of dissent. Now, I think I've taken too much time. What women are doing at the moment now. Now, I'll just take five minutes. Can I?
No.
1 minute. Okay. Last year in 87, at least 1,000 women belonging to 25 different Muslim organizations marched the capital of Pakistan, Islamabad, and there were at least 100 Muslim theologians at the same time simultaneously standing in front of the Legislative Assembly. And they were demanding that the Muslim Sharia law, which had been introduced in the legislation, should not be passed. And this law says that the Sharia courts based on the law of Islam should be introduced, that women should not be allowed to work, and all those who are working in the universities like me, colleges or in the offices, should be asked to go back to their homes, and they should be forced to resign their jobs. That is a threat, definitely a threat to Muslim women, and they have to find out an alternative. Is there any option? And all of us in Pakistan at the moment, for your information, are in search to find out an option for ourselves and for our daughters. And we are hopeful, confident, that this is not going to happen and that the struggle will continue till we achieve success. Thank you very much.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Dr. Tahira Aftab, Professor of History at the University of Karachi, Karachi, Pakistan. Her lecture was entitled Islamic Law and Women's Rights. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.